All right, hello, hello everyone. Welcome to this week's seminar. This week we've got Sergey from the Imperial College London, who's going to talk about accelerating time averaging by having a live representative of the Missouri function. Sergey, I'm going to speak.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, okay. First, I'm very happy to be here, especially after this long break in face-to-face and in-person meetings and communication. It's really pleasure. And, you know, you get excited about this, especially after such a break. So, well, I'm very glad to be here and thank you for inviting me. Now, this is a bit of a special walk in the sense that this research continued for a number of years at a very slow pace, because it is something which is a side effect of another research. So thinking about how to make this interesting, I thought, why don't I tell you everything as it is from the very beginning? And the very beginning will not be actually about accelerating time average. Okay, how do you move it here? That's okay, let's see. Aha, that's it. So this is what it is. What happened a few years ago, there was some ideas how to solve the great problem of turbulence, and we were pursuing this with these auxiliary functions. And then at a certain point, there was kind of, well, wait a minute, but maybe we can use those functions in a very different way to accelerate the average. And that's how the talk will be organized. I will tell you first about where it came from, and then we will switch and we will talk about accelerating average according to this plan. So, first, problem of turbulence, the great problem of turbulence, what that is. Over the years, I was interested in it. The most common understanding of what the problem is actually changed. And in order to understand what I mean, we can try to answer this question. Well, okay, we have those computers and they can calculate things and they're becoming better and better and better. So will they solve that problem? For that, you need to understand what the problem is. Here you can see a visualization of the channel flow. It's pretty large Reynolds numbers, the tau 5200, that's a lot. And if you take a small section here and zoom it in, you will see that there are a lot of details even there. And if you zoom it further, still many details there. So this is what everyone here in this room knows is an illustration of the multi-scale nature of turbulence. There are big scales, smaller, and there is a huge disparity between them. So in order to solve it numerically, we need to resolve each and every of these small scales, and that requires a lot of computational resources. But if you have a sufficiently large computer, maybe in the future, you can hope that, yes, you will solve this. And this multi-scale nature is now often referred to as the problem of turbulence. That was not always like that. Because at this point, you can say, wait a minute, but I actually don't need to know all those details. I am working for an engineering department. I want to know friction, time average, and that's it. And you see, when people tell me, oh yeah, well you can have it. You can have it. Just run this calculation. It also gives it. I feel like, well, the following happened. Well, I want a glass of milk. And they come and say, oh yeah, no problem. Just buy the farm and all the cows, and you will have your glass of milk. Wait a minute. I don't want to buy all the farms. I don't want to use those supercomputers. All I want is just a glass of milk. So that is what the essence of the problem of turbulence, how it was understood 100 years ago was, and how I understand it still there. We have our Navier-Stokes equations, we know them. We do not want to buy all the cows. We only want to know the long time average of a certain quantity, I will call it phi, which depends on the velocity distribution. And the problem is, can I mathematically derive an approach to get that value without paying the price of solving the entire equation? That is what the real problem of turbulence is. And that cannot be solved by computers. Because, okay, maybe we will build a computer fast enough to solve the flow in a pipe for much higher Reynolds numbers. Well, there will be an aircraft. We do it for aircraft. Well, there are more complicated equations, Vlasov equations for plasma with a lot of more terms and six dimension spaces. We always have the problem of finding the way to find only what we want to know without finding everything in such a way that we pay less. That will be always there. And that's what, well, many people were trying to solve, to do for many, many years. How do you do this? There are many ways. One, which I will be talking about today, is this. First, you make a step back. You say, well, actually, I don't even need to know this average. Practically speaking, if I will have two numbers, L and B, and I can guarantee that the quantity of interest is in between, and if L and B, upper and lower bound, are close enough for my practical purposes, that's it. And because knowing the bounds is less than knowing the phi by itself, I am going in the same direction. I agree to know less, hoping that I will have to pay less for that knowledge. And that was done. You take the Navier-Stokes equations and you do some mathematics on it, and you prove mathematically that the quantity of interest is within certain bounds. First works Howard and Bousset, but well, then Dorin and Constantine introduced what is called the background flow method. We will not talk about what that is today, or maybe I've mentioned it briefly, but it's current workforce. Hundreds of problems were solved like this, bounds were found. But well, there is one thing which is essential in this situation. Those bounds should be close enough for practical purposes. And this is what we have from the background flow method for the channel flow. This is the formula for the drag coefficient. Now, 12 over array, the lower bound, it's just the laminar flow, and you can prove that this is. The other bound is background flow method. And you can see that the difference between these two bounds depend on the Reynolds number. And well, the difference is pretty large. Even at 2000 array tau, well, it's 100 times between the bounds. And when the Reynolds number increases, this becomes even more challenging. So while the idea is there and the bounds are there and mathematical method is there, what we do not have or did not have is that we can't actually move these bounds. That's what we have. What can be done about this? Well, this is what was introduced 2014. So it is really relatively recent thing is that auxiliary function method idea. We will explain this idea on the case of not Navier-Stokes, but just some ODE like dA over dt equals f of a. Well, actually f can be anything. So word for word, the same works for PDE. It's just a notation. So we have this equation. It's a dynamical system. And we have a quantity phi, which is actually defined as a function or functional, if it is Navier-Stokes, but here let's be function of A. Then you solve this equation, you substitute A of t, the solution, into phi and average over infinite time, or maybe very large time. And then this is what we actually want to know. This is the horizontal line here. But instantaneous behavior is like that. And then we are saying, as before, that we actually would be satisfied with these bounds, B and L. The way it is plotted here shows that it's not an instantaneous bound. It is the bound for the average. You see that phi might go up and down, but still the mean is in between. That's the setup. How can we solve it? Without paying price of solving the dA over dt equals f of a. Well, let's make a simple observation. Suppose it happened so that phi of a is less than some constant value b. For any value of a, whatever the argument, phi is less than b. Then of course, if you time average it, it still will be less than b. So in this simple situation, we, without solving the equation, immediately have an upper bound b. You can do lower bound as well in this way. The problem with this is that the quantities which we are really interested in do not possess this property. So if you prescribe the velocity, you can calculate the instantaneous drag, but I can always invent such velocity that this drag will be arbitrary large. So actually, that does not work. However, if there is another function d of a, about which I know for sure that if I substitute here a of t, the solution of this equation, then the time average will be exactly zero. Then if phi plus d is less than the constant b, then the time average of phi is also less than the constant of b, because I somehow know that d bar is zero. Do we know such d's? Well, if it is a flow past a circular cylinder, it's symmetric, so the average of the lift is zero. So instead of averaging the drag, I can average the drag plus lift and still have the same result. But well, this is a very special case. So seems that this observation is almost useless. It is not, because there is an infinite supply of those d's, as many as you wish. Because if I take another function, let's call it v, and try to take its derivative dv over dt, and then average over infinite time, then what you see is a simple proof that this average is zero. Indeed, by the fundamental theorem of calculus, you have this integral. This is the average of a finite time t capital. It is just v of t capital minus v of zero divided by t. So if I choose my v so that it is bounded itself, then the time average of dv over dt will be zero. And then, well, that's what we have here. If phi of a plus dv over dt is less than b, therefore, phi bar is also less than b. But v can be arbitrary. Good. Yeah. So it might be pretty difficult to prove that dv capital over dt is less than this constant b for all a's. For that, v should somehow be related to phi. And this is a leap. Instead of taking v to be just explicitly a function of time t as before, we will say that v is a function of a. We can prescribe it arbitrarily, say a squared, a cubed, sine of a, whatever you want, but a function of a. Then dv over dt will be on the solution of the equation, will be the lead derivative, f dot grad v. So it's just a chain rule. dv over dt is dv over dA, which is the grad of v, and then dA over dt is f. So if I will find such a value b and such function v here, that for any a this is valid, then because the average of this lead derivative is guaranteed to be zero, I will have an upper bound for phi. That's the idea. So, but now you take pen and paper if you wish, or do something else, somehow find with. But the important thing is that in this equation here, there is no type at all. So I am not going to solve dA over dt equals f of a. It is not needed anymore. It is rather an algebraic problem. And if you look at the Navier-Stokes equations algebraically, well, that's pretty simple thing algebraically, right? It's not multi-scale something. It's just simples and pretty short. So there is a hope. The background flow method is, I referred before to, is a simple version of this in which first f of a is quadratic in a, like in Navier-Stokes it is. Also the nonlinear terms conserve energy, and v is taken as energy plus a linear functional. Now, when those people were doing this, they did not realize any of that. It was proving this small theorem here as part of a rather complicated reasoning. But that's what the background flow method is. Another thing which is important here, we now have a theorem which proves that under certain conditions that often are satisfied, there exists V which gives arbitrary tight bound B. So that is what I was doing the last few years, and other people were doing other few years, but at this point, that detour happened. So I will start on you. Wait. Well, okay, if I actually can have a tight bound, right? Then this expression phi of a plus f dv grad v, it should fluctuate less because it fluctuates between two values. And if something fluctuates less, maybe it's easier to average. In the ordinary, usual sense, you just take it and that's what the detour will be about. Today's talk, averaging, accelerating averaging. And you, of course, might be, because you were listening, you might be interested. Okay, what about that other thing, that other idea? Well, there are many papers, many publications. Or what I suggest, you probably will get this presentation somewhere. For you, you just click on one of these links, which is the same link, and see what was citing it, and you know how to do this, find this. And there are a lot. But today we will be talking about the detour. What happened when we go away from this? So this is again the same situation, but we will not be doing bounds. We are just saying that we want to calculate the long time average. And now I call the quantity of interest E, and it is just a function of time, T. That's the same behavior we're talking about. We are interested in E bar, the long time average. But when you do it numerically, you replace it with an approximate value like this, 1 over t capital integral from 0 to t of t dt. That's a finite time average. And you hope that if t capital is large enough, then the answer is close enough to the true value you are interested in. That's what we all do in our numerical calculations. Then, of course, there comes the idea of auxiliary function. So if we know about some D, that its time average, proper time average, infinite time average is zero, we can average E plus D or E plus some parameter alpha times D. What we actually hope to achieve here is that if E, the black curve here, and D, or rather alpha D, is correlated with a negative correlation, then the sum of the two will fluctuate less, and hopefully we will be able to get the same accuracy over a shorter time averaging interval. That's what I call accelerating time average. And of course, well, you can optimize over this value of alpha. This optimization written here, in case of one only D, later I will introduce D as a vector and alpha will be the vector. But what I need here is that, well, it's quadratic optimization problem, it's trivial. You find optimal value of alpha. It is related to this ED. That's the correlation between the two. And if it is zero, then alpha is zero. So your D should indeed be somehow related to E. You can't just take something totally unrelated. And another point here to notice is that when you will be doing this in a real numerical calculation, you can't get optimal alpha. It requires averaging over infinite time. So you will actually get it over a finite time as an approximation. This is something which will be important later. So I just make a note here of this. But that gives me the clear-cut plan. I can take any V and take D to be dV over dt here. And then, well, I take just a set of these V's. Yeah. Then I replace E with E plus alpha I di, optimize over alpha i's, and that's it. And enjoy. That's what was the original idea like. And we tried it. Here is our first case on which we will try it. And this is the Lorentz attractor. Here is the simple system of ODEs. And you all know about this. Everyone in fluid dynamics knows that it has this chaotic behavior. The quantity of interest is taken like energy. And these are, well, x, y, z, and so on, all quadratic ones, and one cubic here. As for these, we can explicitly express it over x, y, z, because it's the Lie derivative. So it's how you do this. You have this set, and we are going to try. Another example is the flow past a square at an angle of attack, shown here roughly. It's just Reynolds number 1,000, 15 degrees. You have the carbon vortex street, but with a lot of small details. And then we need to get those V's. And the V's we obtained in the following way. Basically, okay, I will show it later, but we put sensor patches around the body and we took values of various parameters there and got our V's. As for dV over dt, we did not use the equations. After all, you can differentiate numerically as well and get D. So that's what we did. These are two cases which we will consider. In this case, time derivatives are used not. So this is the result. So we have the blue line, fluctuating line, is just the plot of the solution for the Lorentz attractor for this energy. And you do this trick, and you have the curve, which is red, which is almost flat. And if you look at the variance, it's reduced by 1,000 times. So, oh yes, we will be averaging that red instead of the blue, and we will need not average over that long time. When you do this, it kind of works, but in a sense here, what is plotted here is now the parameters like E bar That's the blue curve, the most fluctuating ones, and two other curves as a function of the averaging interval T. Now, of these two curves that are red, these two ones, well, you see, they are coinciding here, but initially they are different. The reason being, the curves are, the one which is dashed line, it is, we calculate it over a long time, we find the optimal value of this alpha, and then we are plotting E plus D with optimal value of alpha as a function of time. This is something which we cannot do when we run high performance calculations as it goes, because this alpha is over a long time averaged data. So all you can actually do, you go step by step and you use that alpha which you have only at this end of your averaging interval. And that is the solid line. You can see that at first, this solid line, that's what we actually have in real calculation, is further away from the true mean value than this optimal one. But then eventually, we have alpha becoming close to alpha optimal, the curves start coinciding. And then, well, yes, we have certain improvement. So success. But if you look at this very carefully, well, something strange is happening there at the end, right? This, well, probably blue line is still jumps above too far away from the mean than the red one. But the red one is not at the mean. We will talk about this later. Here is what happens for the case two. The meaning of this is exactly the same. In this case, the reduction in the fluctuating amplitude is noticeably small, only 5 times. And the sensors are located at those gray boxes. And what we actually do, we take the kinetic energy average of all the each patch. That's the first 10 of these. Then we take horizontal velocity, another 10. And then we take the square combination of those products. So that brings us to 120 something of those Vs. And if we take this, and if we then do averaging, this is the outcome. Well, again, you can see that generally speaking, the solid line, the red line, solid line, is less good initially than the dashed line, but the dashed line is not available until we finish the calculation all the way to this 200 units of time. Well, but then eventually they start to coincide. And yes, it looks like it might be a bit better, but not that much. Right. What happens if we change the initial condition? Here are several plots with different initial conditions, in this case to study. And we will not go through the details. I will tell you that if you look after page after page after page, you start getting an impression that, well, actually, yes, this acceleration kind of on average is favorable. It's it not much, but does something good. And also that it's only works when alphas converge. So initially it's no good, but when you actually got the optimal alpha, after that it works. But in order to understand it more clearly and to measure what we have actually understand what's going on, we would need much more data. So what we do, we take these plots like that, we take many of them, and we plot the averaged variance of the finite time average as a function of the averaging interval. This is a precise measure of what we actually achieve. And this is the case of the Lorentz attractor, because it's much easier, faster calculations are expensive and you need to do a lot. What you see here is that if you don't do any acceleration, it is this wiggly curve on top of this. It wiggles because of the particular properties of the Lorentz attractor. It actually kind of fluctuates around one point, then there is a random jump either back to the same or to another state and so on. And for functions with this nature, you can actually derive that it should have these wiggles. Then, if we take the optimal alpha, then it is this blue curve below. That's what we have. And if you actually plot sigmas for the case that is the real one, how you would do it in the real calculation, it is this green one in between. What you also can see that initially here, we do not have improvement. Improvement here is sigma. The smaller it is, the smaller the error of time averages on average. So this is because alphas are wrong. But once they coincide all the way here, or actually even earlier, where this yellow curve, which is simply the sigma, the error of alpha, effectively, properly measured. Once it drops, we have it. So this is what we have. Two things to say. First, notice that this is a log scale. And because this log scale, that seemingly not that large effect is not that, and seemingly small effect is not that small. It's a long log scale there. And another thing is that when you go all the way to increasing time interval, the average interval, the difference between these curves disappears. It becomes almost zero. And also, well, Hen-Yin Yang is doing a PhD here at this university. You might even know him. And well, those points there were produced by him when he used to be a student doing a project with me at Imperial. The points are there have the following meaning. All this requires coding. And you write the code, and how do you know that there is no bug in it? So we did it independently, him, me, and Owen Tati from Southampton. And when our results coincide numerically, we decided that, well, yeah, it should be okay. So this is something which we need to explain what's going on. And we start with the question of what actually happens, why at sufficiently large T capital, there is no improvement. The answer is actually quite simple. We are dealing with systems that behave chaotically. When the system is behaving chaotically, when the average interval is much greater than the autocorrelation time, characteristic time of the process, then the error sigma decays as 1/√ of the time interval. That's just statistics and probability theory. The error of average error behaves like 1/√(n) for statistically independent quantities. And then, well, it's continuous versions. But what we actually do, we are adding this dv over dt, finite time average, this. That's what we have done. We took our e and added to this e bar, this quantity, and it decays as 1/T. So our corrections, which is aimed to get acceleration, decays as 1/T, while the actual average error decays as 1/√. So eventually our corrections becomes negligible as compared to the error. So that we understand, which basically means that, well, probably we made a mistake in our technology. We were trying to minimize the fluctuations of E. And in this case, as this simple example shows, what actually happens, A and B here, when we try, they're equally important. But when you integrate, then these characteristic times in two modes here, they come to the multipliers. And basically, well, physically that means that when I'm averaging, fast fluctuating modes are averaged very quickly. It's only slow fluctuating things that are important. So rather than minimizing the fluctuation amplitude or sigma of E, I was to find alphas that would minimize the fluctuating, well, the amplitude of E bar of the finite time average. That's how it should be done. Except, well, if you start reading on this, you will discover that estimating sigma of finite time average is one of the big and effectively unsolved problem in statistics. So we can only say, okay, come on. We had some improvement. And because it's so easy to implement as compared to writing a code solving Navier-Stokes on HPC, well, we just use what we have. So this is a similar curves for the case two. And again, it's a log scale. So there is some improvement here, which is absent first. Well, actually, but then we found alphas, it works, and then it gradually disappears. But it's also there. And we would like now to know how large this improvement actually is. So how do you measure this? So far, we were talking about sigma or variance or finite time. That's not about how much CPU time we actually save, right? So we need to convert one to another. And this is how it can be done. What we can do, we can say, okay, I am interested in the result obtained up to a certain error. And well, the square of this sigma squared is what I want to achieve. Now, these are two curves here. Well, actually there are three curves, but two of them overlap because we are already at such large T that alphas already established itself. So it's there. So when you increase T, you go here and your error is decreasing. If I am happy to have a certain level of error, yeah, then I can from here get the averaging interval length, which is required to get that accuracy. Well, if I applied my accelerating averaging technique, then it will be this curve, and therefore I will be able to stop at a small level. That is the acceleration I actually get. Which of these, which, yeah, well, but it's the other way around, sorry. This one is corresponding to original sigma, and the red one is accelerated one. But still, I can have, for given accuracy, the time. And then, well, we can plot these gains. In this case, it is the time which is required divided using the acceleration to the time which is required without acceleration as a function of the relative error of the result. And that's what you can see. If the relative error we are looking at, we wish, is very large, then what happens actually, your averaging interval required is short. And in that short interval, we cannot calculate alpha properly. So actually it is better not to use this technique. But then when you want better and better accuracy, you come to this section where there is an improvement. And for the case one, well, it is not that small. It is something like, okay, well, sometimes it is even greater than 50%, but okay. And eventually, if you go to very high accuracy, it's all going back up there. For the second case, the effect is not that large. We have here something like 19%, so it's 10% reduction in CPU time, which might seem not enough, but I do remember me running around and pleading everyone I know to give me a bit more CPU time in Tobias consortium thing, because we needed very high accuracy time averaged values in what we were doing. Okay, I was happy to get some, but that was a motivation behind this, because that's what I was glad to get, 10%. When someone would, like Neil said himself, okay, in our group, you can get this part. And it was 10% from what I've already had, and that was all. So this is the technology we have there. It is very easy to implement, but the effect is not that large. So what it comes to is when you do particular research, you probably need to write all the codes. And I did not say anything at all about how exactly it's all done. And there are non-trivial things, because the problem of finding alphas actually is not necessarily well posed. It might be ill-conditioned. Just imagine that I, by accident, took two Vs that are the same. That's it. And I don't actually know what happens there. So, well, writing the code would be an investment for you. And then what you get might be not that important for you. But if you already have this code, then it is a bit stupid not to use it. So the code can be obtained from me. Right. And these are my conclusions. Well, the first is the essence of the method. It's pretty simple. Rather than average it, what I am interested in, I average that plus something of which I exactly know that something has a zero average. And you have a lot of expressions like this, like Lie derivatives, or simply you just take these and take the. Remember, they have to be related to the solution. Well, philosophically, what we are doing, we are saying, if you are calculating everything, then those other quantities, like lift, do have some information contained in them about the system. And what this technology does, it uses this information in order to improve our estimate of the average of the quantity of interest, say drag. That's the philosophy behind it. But well, that's how it works. And then you just select a set of V's and optimize their linear combination. That's the simplest approach. It is not theoretically best. But well, that's difficult to go on. Maybe in the future we will manage it, but I need workforce and I need time and everything, but it is interesting. And the last conclusion is just saying what we got. And we got up to 50% in a very favorable case, 10% in a much more realistic case. And it's not always there. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And that's it. That's all I wanted to tell you. Thank you for your attention.
So what's the saving for turbulence? Have you tried with the same analysis?
Not yet. We have not tried yet. And the reason is, well, first, because I do not have that much data. I don't do calculations myself. So in order to do something like this, I would need to at least take the database of a turbulent flow. And it has to be long enough in order to do this properly. This is one of the big things which happens for someone like myself. You look at people doing remarkable calculation, and then you have an idea, well, yes, I would wish this. And they say, but sorry, we only keep the data of this and this, but not everything. This is a repetitive kind of thing. You have to communicate. So this is one thing. But another thing is, of course, just not enough time. To be honest, auxiliary functions on paper is something which I spend more time with. This is a slow going stuff.
So So you need the history, not just of the friction, but the friction.
Oh yes, of course, I need to be able to calculate dV over dt. For that, I need to have V at time t plus V at time t plus delta t. And nobody does that. They at best say, well, okay, it is representative enough, but it's not good enough to calculate derivatives with required accuracy. We did experiments in, well, kind of not using every step, but then the information is going away. You do need to have correlations between the two. And this is something which people usually do not want to do it. Then the solution is, okay, take the database, take these points, make one teeny step using the code, and you will have that. But I don't have the code. So it's not that easy. And well, we will do it one day, maybe. But the most immediate plan is just to put these codes into public domain so that anyone who wishes to get a bit of improvement on the accuracy of time averaging will just download it and use it. Because that is it. Okay.
Did you comment on the overshoots of compared to the mean?
Ah, yeah. Okay. Yes. I did not say anything, but actually, and well, it's a pity that I don't have. No, it was actually this one. Well, it is only 220. If you go on to 2000, you will discover the following: this averaged curve. It goes smaller, and then it jumps, and then starts to converge again, the blue one, and jumps again and again and again. This is when the Lorentz attractor switches from one to another in a particularly violent way, because sometimes it switches fast and you don't see anything. Actually, there are switches here. You can see something happened, right? It's bigger. This one and this interval is a bit bigger than this. So those are jumps between a vicinity of two unstable points, but stationary points in the Lorentz attractor. So if you go for a long way, you will see that this curve is trying to follow this. And because the interval between these switches is pretty large, and because we suppress short-term fluctuations in the same way as long-term. And so the red curve almost does not work for this long-term component of this. So yes, we understand what happened, but in a sense, that is described by the plot I showed later. Eventually, these two curves will coincide anyway. By design. Okay. Thank you.